15. The four of them appeared in the woods just outside of Ledchurch. They moved cautiously to the edge of town, hiding behind trees and shrubs just in case someone happened to look their way. As they walked, they plotted their route to Philip's place. While Gilbert and Sid doubted that there was any malfeasance on Philip's part, they had agreed that it was possible and that it was best to catch him by surprise. Gilbert held his arms out wide, flourished with his fingers, making sure to touch his thumb to the crease at the first knuckle of each of his fingers, then threw a non-existent golf ball at the ground as he said, "Ninja vanish," and disappeared in a puff of smoke. Sid, Maddie, and Brewster all followed suit. Soon there was no sign of their presence, save for some visual distortions, the remaining smoke, and the sound of coughing.
"Maybe you can make a version without the smoke bombs,"
Maddie said, between dry, hacking coughs.
"For when nobody's gonna be around?"
"No,"
Sid said, choking back his own coughs.
"It's absolutely crucial that you do things the right way. Even if nobody else will ever know, you'll know. And your opinion of your work's as important as anybody else's."
Gilbert said,
"At any rate, we should get a move on before some peasant sees all this smoke and comes looking for a forest fire."
After a moment, the bent upper ends of their periscopes appeared, poking out of their cloaking fields, about 7 feet above the forest floor. All of the periscopes swung about and lurched back and forth as they turned to one side, then the other, sweeping their glass lenses about, trying to spot each other. Gilbert said,
"Right, my periscope is the one bouncing up and down. Can you all see me?"
Brewster, Maddie, and Sid all said that they could.
"Good, I'll lead. Follow me, single file, and if someone falls behind, let us know."
The four floating periscope tips bobbed and swayed their way through the trees, across a stretch of tall grass and into town.
"You sure you know where we're going?" Maddie whispered.
"Yeah, been there once. Philip invited us over for lunch. It's just around the corner here."
Brewster said,
"I'm more worried about when we're going than where. Philip can travel through time. There's no way to know at what point in his life he attacked our parents. We could be here way before or way afterward."
"True," Sid said. "But this is an excellent place to start. When you become a time traveler, routines, patterns, and procedures become surprisingly important. Life becomes a confounding kaleidoscope of conundrums and chaos."
Gilbert said,
"When we get home, you're sticking a dollar in the alliteration jar."
"Apologies, it just slipped out. Anyway, while Philip could leave the theatre every night and go literally any place and anywhere, he doesn't. Nor does Martin. They go back to the place they consider home, at a point sometime after they left, usually about the length of time they were gone."
"Otherwise, it's easy to end up staying awake for 20 hours straight and saying things like, 'I haven't slept in over a century.' It's not healthy. Messes with your sense of reality."
"Which is hard enough to keep on the straight and narrow in our case, as you can well imagine,"
Sid added.
"So, knowing Philip's general schedule and how many shows he does a week, it was a matter of simple arithmetic to determine that this should be a day or two after whatever happened with him and your parents, if he's kept to his pattern. If he hasn't, then maybe we can get some information."
"Or perhaps this Philip will help us," Gilbert said.
Maddie asked, "Why would Philip help us confront himself at some other time in his life?"
"On account of the human condition. The young tend to be disgusted at what they become, and the old have contempt for what they once were."
Maddie said,
"Ugh, that's awful. That can't be true."
Gilbert laughed.
"I'm going to go forward in time to when you're in your 40s and remind you that you said that. I bet we'll share a laugh over it."
Brewster whispered,
"Hey guys, just because we're invisible doesn't mean we're inaudible. Shouldn't we try to be quiet?"
Sid said, yes, we should, but it isn't essential in this case. Nobody's that close to us, and these people have been living in proximity to your parents and their friends for years now. They've grown accustomed to much stranger things than some disembodied voices. Watch this.
Sid cleared his throat and in a loud, clear voice said, pardon me, ma'am. A peasant woman who was walking the other direction across the street stopped and looked around, searching for whoever had addressed her.
I'm sorry to bother you, and for the fact that you can't see me. I'm hoping you can direct me to the local wizard.
The woman relaxed, and while she still kept searching around, not knowing where to address her answer, she said,
oh, it's just a few more doors down that way on the right. Is there about to be trouble? Should I be running?
No, I just want to talk to him. It's about all I can do, as you can imagine, being a disembodied voice and all.
The woman nodded and walked away. As the four floating periscopes continued down the street, Maddie grumbled,
I thought we were supposed to be sneaking. What's the point of being invisible if we go around talking to people?
Gilbert said,
we don't want Philip to see us coming. We don't care if a few citizens hear us coming.
Besides, Sid said, were it not for the invisibility spells, we would be gallivanting around in our tuxedos, which in this time would draw much more attention than disembodied voices ever could. People in this time period are notorious for their irrational hostility toward the overdressed.
The four of them came to a stop in front of a two-story, thatch-roof building with a sign over the door that said, Wizard, and a second sign on the door that said, Out. Through the window, they could make out shelves full of small bottles and various powders, liquids, and unidentifiable objects, but little else. Maddie said,
the sign says he's not here.
Sid said,
indeed it does, my young friend, but in time you'll learn that printing something on a board doesn't make it true. For example, in my experience, slower traffic seldom keeps right.
Brewster said, the lights are out. That might suggest that he really isn't here.
It also suggests that we're in the 1400s and electric lights haven't been invented yet,
Gilbert said.
Don't feel bad. Time travel takes a lot of getting used to, but you have to keep in mind where and when you are. Besides, it doesn't matter if he's home or not. We're going in either way. Take off your hats, kiddos. This'll be good practice for you. We're teleporting in. 10 feet forward should do it.
As the twins removed and reached into their hats, the displays built into the hats' linings lit up, allowing them to see the interfaces despite the light warping invisibility spell surrounding them on the outside. A few seconds later, they all stood in the front room of Philip's shop. They removed their invisibility spells and put their hats back on. Maddie stepped closer to the shelves lining the back wall. There, in a place of prominence, a creature that appeared to be the front half of a dead squirrel, stuffed, shaved, and sewn to the back half of a dead frog, stuffed, and with hair glued to it, lay in a large glass jar.
What kind of person would have something like this?
She muttered, not really expecting an answer. Sid gave her one.
A person who's attempting to convince superstitious peasants that he is a wizard. These are simply props, Maddie, nothing more. Gilbert and I own an apparatus that looks as if it was designed solely to cut people into three equal parts and then to display the segments. Our apparatus is better designed and far less dust-covered, but the same principle applies. This way now. If Philip's here, he's going to be upstairs.
Gilbert led the twins through a beaded curtain into the darkened seance room. Sid brought up the rear. They walked around a table holding a crystal ball, past velvet draperies scrawled with logos of various 80s rock bands, altered slightly to look like arcane runic symbols. At the back of the room, they came to a door which led to stairs. The four of them climbed the staircase. Gilbert looked back over his shoulder at the others.
I'm told at one time he had a lot of spells and such on this door and staircase, and nobody but him could see what he had up here.
Brewster said,
that seems suspicious.
It was, Gilbert said. Everybody thought so, even your parents. But it turns out he wasn't up to anything bad.
How'd they find out?
Brewster asked.
He told them.
Maddie snorted.
Yeah, that proves it.
They stepped up onto the landing and soaked in their surroundings. Track lighting illuminated furniture made of white, leather, and chrome, and framed posters depicted women with snow-white skin and jet-black hair standing in front of pastel-colored triangles and squiggly lines. The room also contained a massive rack-mounted stereo with speakers the size of tombstones, a full-size arcade cabinet, and a white Pontiac Fiero.
As you can see, Sid said, Philip chooses to live in the past, both literally and figuratively.
Maddie opened her mouth to speak, but she never got the words out. At that moment, a huge, white, furry creature with tusks on the side of its head, sharp yellow teeth, and long black claws appeared in the middle of the room. The creature roared and swiped its massive paws menacingly. Next to the monster, a man appeared. He wore a trench coat and a fedora with a long, pointed top sewn over the crown. He had a 5 o'clock shadow and iron gray hair and wielded the bridge cue from a pool table in his hands. On the other side of the monster, a ball of flame roared into existence, then stretched in two directions, becoming a line that bent around tight corners until it formed a pentagram of fire in midair. The light and heat from the flames flashed brighter before subsiding, fading away to reveal a thin, pale man in a black robe and hat. His right foot stuck out from the hem of the robe and appeared to consist only of bare bone stripped of flesh. Behind him, another man appeared, smaller and less well-groomed, wearing a tuxedo jacket over a shirt and pants that appeared to be made of burlap. This second man held a gunny sack with a pentagram painted on its front. The man in the trench coat said,
You're trespassing. Stop right where you are and drop those canes.
Or what? Sid asked. You'll pot us like a black ball at the crucible?
The man in the trench coat looked confused. Sid said,
You're holding a billiards cue. It's a snooker reference. You Yanks, there are games other than 8-ball, you know.
And really, a wampa?
Gilbert said to the white furry creature.
That's the scariest thing you could think of to turn into. All it really did was slap Luke on the side of the face and scratch him with its fingernails. You might as well have shown up here as a real housewife of Beverly Hills.
The man in the black robe shouted,
Shut up!
Oh, very good, Sid said. That's certainly in keeping with your theme. Lo, a fearsome wizard sprang forth from a fiery pentagram, and in a voice throbbing with arcane power, bade us to shut up.
The wizard turned to the filthy man in the tuxedo jacket.
Hubert! Hand me the Rod of Raimi.
What is he? Your caddy?
Gilbert asked. Maddie leaned toward Brewster and whispered,
Do they look familiar to you?
Brewster squinted.
Yeah, maybe.
The dirty little man in the tuxedo jacket reached into his gunny sack and pulled out a bronze stick about a foot long, decorated with tiny carvings of skulls and demons. He handed it to the wizard in black, who whipped it forward at Gilbert, Sid, Maddie, and Brewster as if he were casting a rod and reel. A bright light shone from the upper corner of the room, accompanied by a loud tearing noise. The four of them couldn't help but look at it. As their heads turned in unison, the world seemed to shift beneath their feet. Later, they theorized that the spell somehow affected their inner ears. But the result was the feeling that the entire world had suddenly, jarringly, tilted 20 degrees. Then the light went out, replaced by a torrent of viscous green and brown fluid that flowed down over them, covering their faces and drenching their clothing. They grabbed each other for support, but only managed to pull each other down into a slippery, writhing heap. They all wallowed for a moment. Then the fluid gathered together and lifted off of them, flying back the direction it had come, as if someone had simply reversed the film. Maddie, Brewster, Gilbert, and Sid all lay, bone dry, jumbled on the floor, like the aftermath of a drunken game of Twister. Any sign of the repulsive flood that had knocked them over was gone. Sid picked up his hat from the ground and scrambled to his feet.
Right! Enough of this foolishness!
He bared his teeth as he reached into his hat, rummaged around a bit, then pulled out a rabbit. Out of sheer instinct, the wizard in black and the wampa both applauded, until the wizard in the trench coat glared at them, shaming them into silence. Sid let go of the rabbit, which shot toward the wizards without so much as touching the ground first. It latched onto the throat of the man in the trench coat. He and the rabbit struggled briefly. Then the rabbit launched itself toward the wampa. The towering white beast swiped with its huge paw, knocking the bunny away and toward the wizard in black, who caught it just before the rabbit's teeth reached his face. Brewster asked,
"Were you at our parents' wedding?"
"Yes," Maddie shouted. "That's it, they were." "You were dressed like a freeman."
Maddie pointed at the man in the trench coat. She moved her hand to point at the wizard in black.
"And you. You were wearing a padded bodysuit and a blue Speedo. And I think we sat next to you at the theater when we went to Dad's show."
The wizard in black looked away from the struggling rabbit in his hands and studied the twins.
"Are you Brewster and Maddie? Wow! I didn't recognize you."
The wizard in the trench coat said,
"You've gotten so big."
The wampa nodded, opened its mouth, and let out a fearsome roar. It stopped abruptly, held up a single finger, made some quiet sounds like a large dog half-heartedly barking, and transformed into a black wizard in a purple robe and hat.
"I said, you're practically grown-ups. Where are your parents? And who are these guys? Are they bothering you?"
"Are we bothering them?" Gilbert asked.
"You're the ones who hosed them down with gore."
Maddie said,
"These are Gilbert and Sid, they're friends of Dad."
The man in the trench coat said,
"Oh yeah, of course. We've heard of you. You're the guys from across the street. I'm Roy."
The black man in the purple robe said,
"I'm Tyler."
The man in black said,
"I'm Gary. This is my butler, Hubert. Sorry about the rod of Raimi. It's just that Philip's been missing for a couple of days. We can't even find him using the file. We've got our friend Jeff working on it right now. Then you all appear at Philip's place, and we kind of assumed the worst."
"What are you doing here?"
Tyler asked.
"Looking for Philip ourselves," Gilbert said. "The kids believe he may have attacked Martin and Gwen."
Roy said,
"He didn't."
Maddie asked,
"What? What do you mean he didn't? How would you know?"
"If there's one thing I'm sure of, it's that Philip would never hurt either of your parents."
"Yes," Sid said. "That's precisely what we told them."
"You don't know,"
Brewster said.
"We were there. We know what we saw."
"And that's precisely the answer we got as well,"
Sid added.